All right, welcome back, folks. Again, if there's one set of charts that shows the collapse in real time, this is adult milestones of 30-year-olds who have achieved certain milestones, living on their own, and it's the comparison between 1983 and 2023. So in 40 years, you can see an absolute collapse in the number of people who at age 30 live on their own, have ever been married, own a home, or live with a child, meaning that we're not progressing. We're not building families. We're not creating lineages. We're not building generational wealth. We're not doing anything. We're just working just as hard, scrimping just as much, laboring away just as intensely as previous generations. We're just not getting anything for it. It's all being robbed from us before it can be turned into something permanent and valuable. And it's on purpose. Let's go to Clifteen here. This is a very common argument made. I first heard Thomas Sowell make it. And it's so simple and obvious. It really makes you wonder how people are able to discount it and just continue to do what they're doing already. It's the problem with affirmative action, the problem with DEI, the problem with diversity for diversity's sake. Let's watch.
It's really a cruel thing for anybody to be catapulted into an environment for which he's not competitively qualified. They don't do well. And this is the same thing if for gender preferences. If MIT admitted me with math SATs of 650 on an 800-point scale because they felt they needed more gender diversity in their engineering class because there weren't enough females there, as if I care about the sex of somebody that is building a bridge that I want to get across safely. All I care is that the best possible engineer for that job. But MIT has different ideas and thinks the gonads of engineers matter to their competence. So it admits me with 650 on an 800-point scale on math, and my peers who've been admitted based on merit, not gonads, all have 800s. I am going to struggle in my math classes in freshman year because I've been admitted to a peer group that is more academically qualified than I am. Now, I can still go to engineering school. I should go with students that also average 650, and my freshman calculus class and my freshman engineering and chemistry class will be pitched to my level of academic preparedness. But if I'm sent into MIT, it's frankly going to be hell on earth, because I'm going to be behind, and lo and behold, what happens? The diversity bureaucrats show up and tell me, if you're feeling out of place, if you're struggling, if you're not doing as well as your peers, it's because you're in a rape culture. It's because you're in a patriarchy. It's because you are surrounded by a female hostile environment. They're not going to be honest and say, no, it's because you've been catapulted into an academic environment for which you are not competitively qualified. Now, the argument is always, but they'll do better. They'll catch up. They don't. It would be nice if they did, but they don't catch up. They struggle. It is cruel. It is an act of narcissism and ego on the part of these college administrators who only care about the photos that show up on their college website and making sure that they're suitably diverse, and do not care about the fate of Black students who have been admitted.
So again, she's exactly right, except they don't just care about how the photos look on their website. They're in a war against white people. And they think that tearing us down or building themselves up are basically the same. All that matters is comparatively they do better than us. So now they care a lot. They care about destroying white people, and they're succeeding. You don't have to take it.
I love knives. I know you love knives. They have finally gotten a whole bunch of the knives that were sold out back in, and they've gotten a bunch of new, really nice flip knives. These bad boys right here. I mean, these are absolutely amazing. Flip really easy and locks for you. This is forest green, murdered out. It's got my little signature on it, so it's a little piece of history. It's a great memento. It's a great gift for your friends and family, and it funds the operation. And they're up to 50% off right now at thealexjonesstore.com. And while you're there, get some ultramethylene blue.
What do you got there, Angel Eyes?
It's a new Patriot Silver folding knife from thealexjonesstore.com.
Hey, Blondie, look at me. I got all three.
Have you ever been experienced? Well, we have. Let us show you now on The War Room with Harrison Smith.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is The War Room. Let me tell you right now that it is your last chance to get 100 times entries and your last chance to win one of the two vehicles and $20,000 from thealexjonesstore.com. Every dollar you spend gets you 100 times entries. In other words, every penny you spend at thealexjonesstore.com gets you an entry to win one of these two incredible cars, the Ford F-250 diesel. That raffle ends tonight. The Ford Mustang Shelby GT500 will continue for another week, but tonight is your last chance to get entries into both of these drawings. Somebody's got to win the car. So somebody listening to my voice right now, going to thealexjonesstore.com, thealexjonesstore.com/Harrison, somebody's going to win it. Might as well be you, but you got to go now and buy something from thealexjonesstore.com. Of course, we make it easy for you to do so because every order gets a free 1776 hat. And it's a very cool design. It's not, you know, sometimes people do giveaways where it's something that you would never buy anyway. No, this is like a best-selling hat. It's like a very cool hat. We could sell it for probably $30 if we wanted to, but we're giving it to you for absolutely free with any purchase from thealexjonesstore.com, thealexjonesstore.com/Harrison. If you want to let them know who sent you and you have until midnight tonight to be entered to win both cars and $20,000, you got to go today, thealexjonesstore.com/Harrison. And with that, we'll move on here and talk about Iran, I guess, and Israel, I guess. We have a lot to cover in this hour before we welcome Tiffany Cianci. And I want to talk about tariffs as well, although I know she's going to have a lot to say about that. But I think let's finish off with the coverage that we've been sticking with, because I got a few more videos here. Because slowly but surely, the tide is turning, and white people are learning to defend themselves. It's a beautiful thing, really. It's all we've ever called for here at InfoWars. It's just for white people to act like everybody else acts. Just stop committing suicide. Stop acting like being taken advantage of is moral. Stop acting like being screwed over and attacked and destroyed somehow is deserved and you're a good person for putting up with it. We just need to break out of this hypnosis. Doesn't mean that you hate anybody. Doesn't mean that you want other races not to do well. It's literally just about applying the exact same level of consideration for every other people group. Just apply it to yourself. It's really not that hard. It's just hard because of the normalization of really vicious anti-white sentiment the world over. In the UK, this is particularly heinous because, you know, at least in America, we do have a history of immigration, right? Our country never existed without a sizable population of not white, non-European people. So, you know, the arguments about, you know, an ethnicity that has a claim to this land, I mean, it's a little debatable. I mean, Doesn't mean white people are colonizers that deserve to be driven off the land, obviously. It just is a little bit of a different situation than you might find somewhere like Ireland or England, where there's no nuance or debate or discussion about it. I mean, the natives of those lands are white. They're the white natives of Europe. That's who's always been there. If they don't have that homeland, they don't have a homeland. So there's no other option. So Rupert Lowe, who just started the Restore Britain Party, has come out and taken a big step towards, you know, white self-esteem or whatever you might call it. And this is very good to see. And we, you know, congratulate Europe for producing a single leader willing to actually speak out for the concerns of the people they're supposed to be the leaders of. Let's go to clip 23 here. This is Rupert Lowe with a message for young white men. Let's watch.
To the young white men who feel ignored and insulted, I want to speak directly to you. For too long, young white men in this country have been treated as if your concerns don't matter, your struggles don't count, and your identity is something to apologize for. That your love of your country is somehow racist and wrong. You've been told to stay quiet, to step aside, to accept being blamed for things you never did and problems that you didn't create. Let me be clear. There is nothing wrong with being white. There is nothing wrong with being man. There is nothing wrong with being straight. You are not the problem. The system is the problem. The cancer of DEI, along with the Blairite legacy, must be eradicated and erased from our society. Britain needs strong, grounded, responsible men. Men and women who work hard, protect their communities, build their families, and stand firm in their values. And despite what some might tell you, there's nothing shameful about wanting to be that person. We should be unapologetic in our promotion of those ideals. I say to you today, keep going. It will get better.
So again, an absolutely positive message that young men absolutely need to hear. And, you know, it's a message obviously aimed towards and for the benefit of young white people, young white men in particular. But really, you know, non-whites need to hear it as well. I'll show you why in just a second. But once again, I'm dissatisfied. I'm happy. I'm glad it's getting, you know, towards where we should be. But the problem is, like, where society is now is so far from where we should be that, yeah, movements towards the right direction we'll celebrate and are positive, but we have a long way to go. And in a way, you know, we just need to take everything that Benjamin Netanyahu and the ADL say about Jewish people and just apply it to white people. How many times have you heard Benjamin Netanyahu give speeches in the last month or so where he says, just to be against anti-Semitism is not enough? Yeah, you have to fight against it. You have to be proactive. You have to actively go out and be philo-Semitic, I guess. That's kind of how we need to be. Like, yeah, okay, the message, like, you shouldn't be ashamed for being white is a good one. But why would you even say that? Of course you shouldn't be ashamed for being white. That should go without saying. No, you should be proud of being white. No, you need to take it a step farther. We don't need to be telling young white men that it's okay, that it's fine that they are who they are, that, like, it's not that bad. Like, you don't need to apologize. No. What you need to be telling young white men is, young white men, you are the inheritors of the greatest inheritance the world has ever seen. That the vast majority of intellectual, scientific, even religious developments on the face of the earth have all come from young white men. Young white men are the engine of growth and progress and advancement the world over, and have been for all of time. It's not just okay to be white. It's fantastic. It's amazing. Okay, so I'm gonna keep pushing in that direction and hoping everybody comes along in our wake. But you got to understand the subtle but important difference between, you don't need to be ashamed for who you are, And hey, who you are is amazing and fantastic, and you should be proud of who you are. And really, that's the insinuation anyway. Anyway, the insinuation of like you have to be sorry, you know, feel bad is like literally because like your race was so unbelievably successful and powerful that like it makes other people feel bad. Again, it's kind of like an inverted white supremacy where it's like, ooh, I'm white. Sorry. Like, I don't know. You ever succeed wildly in something that your friend didn't and you feel kind of bad? You don't want to go brag, right? You want to kind of feel sorry for him. So we need to get over that. We can absolutely get over that. And here's why. Clip 49 here. Because white people have, many of them have been convinced to simply give up their history and their heritage, to think that it's bad, and to go along with the people telling them that, oh, you're the evil ones, you're the divisive ones, just get rid of your history and then we can all be together. Like, that was always a lie, obviously, and people are stupid and fell for it, or have just had their heritage deliberately stolen from them against their will. Like, Black Lives Matter tearing down statues that everybody in the community other than them wanted up and reflected their past and ancestors and everything else. And so we've had our history and heritage demonized and stolen from us. And now you got foreigners coming in and looking around and going, there's no history or heritage here. I guess they don't care. Let's go to clip 49 now.
The United States still is a migrant community, and you know, with due respect to the Native Americans, it's a new society. So it has doesn't have the same traditions, religions, and same monuments, for example, that you can go back and say, oh, this is the, you know, Christian emperor, so and so did. So that's why U.S. provides much more of a broad space for adaptation and assimilation. So it is, in a sense, immigrant society, and being American means being everything, a little bit of everything.
They don't even have monuments because you tore them all down. So they'll tear down the monuments and then say, look, they don't even have monuments. They don't have a history or a culture. There's nothing to assimilate to. We're all a little bit of everything. So it's not a matter of even like ego, like feeling good about yourself or whatever else. It's an existential thing. Actually, this is an existential thing that like I feel like we really need to go hard on, because whether we like it or not, we're a collective. And when a bunch of my fellow white people feel bad about themselves, it puts me in danger. So, like, y'all got to get over this. Y'all got to get over thinking you're better than everybody else and feeling sorry for everybody. They hate you and are trying to kill you. Stop feeling sorry for them. Jesus. Let's go to clip 24 here, because there is growing backlash to this. There's a growing sentiment of what I'm talking about developing around the world. And so, some people who have contributed mightily to the anti-white agenda are now sort of reversing course, sort of moderating their position. And we're seeing this across the board with Hillary Clinton and Klaus Schwab. They're all saying, well, maybe this migrant thing isn't such a big deal. You know, maybe we did overdo it with the migrants. Maybe, you know, giving some credence to that argument. And here we have Sam Harris, noted libtard, a brain-broken, TDS-suffering moron, atheist, pseudo-philosopher. And he actually gets in an argument with Don Lemon because he's, you know, recognizing the severe disadvantage that white people face in our own countries, and he's choosing to acknowledge it. I don't trust him for a single second. I think this is a purely, like, cynical and Machiavellian strategy shift. I don't think Sam Harris has woken up and seen the light. It would have been nice for him at any point in the last 10 years... 20 years that he's been a public intellectual to, you know, defend against the heinous blood libels against white people and the, you know, underlying societal conditions that has led to our dispossession. Sort of too little too late old Sam Harris to be sounding off about this, but better late than never, right? Let's go to clip 24.
No one was more disadvantaged based purely on the superficial characteristics of skin color than white men for a very long time getting into high status. Now, I'm not saying racism doesn't exist. I'm not saying there are no disadvantages.
You don't believe that, do you?
Oh,
look at the numbers. The numbers don't bear that out. That's not true. I operate in a circle of a lot of white people who attend Ivy League schools. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the folks their kids are attending these schools have endowment. They give money to the schools. They put libraries in the schools.
Legacy is also another corruption of the system. Yeah.
And I barely, if ever, see a black person among them. Rarely.
Okay. If you look at the numbers,
the numbers are not there. Look at the representation of white men and black women in every type of business.
We have to be systematic in how we talk about this, Don, because the facts are there for anyone to find in terms of, I mean, just if you're going to ask yourself, you know, like internships at the New York Times, who has gotten those internships, right? The first rung on the ladder in recent years. And you look at the percentages that go to white men versus
all white kids who have
not true. It's absolutely not true.
Sam, it is. I work in the media business. Every single person is someone who comes from a legacy, or someone who can pick up the phone and.
So I mean, you know, Don Lemon's obviously just lying. We've seen the charts, and you know, this has been a rapid shift, right? So nowadays, we've seen 93%+ of all executive positions went to non-white people. Deliberately, they celebrate it. They brag about this. Obviously, it's going to take a couple years for the old legacy people to drop out, but the damage has already been done. And the white people who would be on a path to success and building careers are not doing that anymore. They've been shuffled off to lower level positions, despite being qualified for the high level position ones because of the racial makeup that they want to decide. I also think it's valuable in times like this to differentiate between people with white skin, as Sam Harris puts it, and white Christian Europeans versus Jews, because that can throw the whole thing off, right? And, whatever, the language is imperfect or whatever, because Jewish people obviously have white skin. However, if you say, this is all white males, but it's all a bunch of Jewish people who are considered minorities and a different ethnicity and have all of the same benefits as any of the other minorities over white people. Like, then it's a little bit different. And this especially comes into play with things like Sam Harris was talking about, or Don Lemon was talking about, who goes to Ivy League schools. And again, this is why this is important to take on head on and to not mitigate or qualify these statements about but I'm not a white supremacist, but I do think it's like, no, we got to get rid of all that and be done with all of that. Because what happens is the fear of supporting white people, the fear of advocating for white interests, means that we can't solve problems that are predicated on attacking white identity. This is the perfect example for it. Trump DOJ sues Harvard for withholding race-related admission docs. The U.S. Civil Rights Division filed a lawsuit against Harvard University on Friday, alleging the school unlawfully withheld admissions-related information that federal officials say they needed to determine whether Harvard is complying with federal civil rights law following the Supreme Court's 2023 decision in Students for Fair Admissions versus President and Fellows of Harvard College. In the complaint, the government says it opened compliance reviews in April 2025 covering Harvard College, Harvard Medical School, and Harvard Law School to assess whether the university continues to discriminate on the basis of race in admissions, a violation of Title VI of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. Title VI bars race, color, and national origin discrimination in programs receiving federal financial assistance. Under President Trump's leadership, the Department of Justice demanding better from our nation's educational institutions, said Attorney General Pam Bondi. Long story short, they refused to say white people are being discriminated against, so they chose to champion Asian students, because Asian students are also discriminated against, and it's more socially safer to support Asians, because in America they're technically a minority. And so what Harvard did was they stopped discriminating against Asian people and started discriminating against white people even more. Do you see the problem? That like when you're afraid to actually advocate for white people and you just say, well, we just don't want any discrimination. It's not about white people. No, we don't want anybody being discriminated against. It's like, okay, well, they're only discriminating against two types of people, Asians and whites. And you refuse to acknowledge the considerations of white people, so you only advocate for Asian people, so they stop getting discriminated against, but white people get discriminated against to an even greater degree. It's absolutely infuriating. Harvard was so upset when told they couldn't racially discriminate, they decided to be more vindictive and racially discriminate only against white Americans. They dropped admissions of whites by 16%. Their own data shows in a merit system, whites would be 50% of the freshmen. Instead, they like hardly show up. So that's what happens when you refuse to champion white people. White people get screwed over. They're like, well, we got to go, you know, stop discrimination. Harvard's like, oh, okay. And then white enrollment drops 16%. And then everybody that they did bring in that wasn't technically qualified but boosted because of their skin color, they can't quite make the grade that they used to. So the entire institution is degraded overall. Because you have to, you know, round the tests up a little bit more. You know, provide a little bit of a little boost for the grades so that your whole diversity experiment doesn't blow up in your face and prove that you're incapable of, you know, choosing the right people for matriculation. It destroys the whole system. It destroys the whole institution. It degrades it imperceptibly, but, you know, by steps over time until why do we even have colleges? There's extended daycares. Ridiculous. Harvard did not stop discriminating by race. It simply stopped doing so against Asians. Affirmative action continues, but now it's entirely at the expense of one race instead of two. Since the ruling was issued, the share of Asians in Harvard's freshman class has gone up from 26% of the class in 2025 to 41% of the class in 2029, but the share of whites has gone down. White students were 47% of freshmen in the class of 2025 and approximately 31% in the classes of 28 and 29. Harvard publishes percentage of every race, but white in those years, and 8% of each class reported no race, making the white share a matter of inference. Black and Latino share has stayed roughly the same with small fluctuation. So Harvard did not stop discriminating by race. It simply stopped doing so against Asians. Affirmative action continues, but now it's entirely at the expense of white people instead of white people and Asians. And then you have to wonder how many of those white people are Jews. Do they get counted separately? And if not, then you're not only talking about a 16% drop in admission, you're probably talking about a much more significant one. And of course, Jews are overrepresented in all Ivy League, but I don't see a lot of complaints about that. And you don't see a lot of complaints about black people or Hispanic people being overrepresented anywhere. If we wanted to actually take their absurd, nonsensical, frankly retarded worldview seriously and sincerely, then Harvard would have to get rid of a bunch of black people because they're overrepresented. They're only 13% of this country, but they occupy like 20% of the university. So that's bad, right? That's bad because it doesn't reflect the population. Or are we going with the population of the world, and so white people are actually a vanishingly small minority and should basically be gatekept from anything that our ancestors built. So yeah, stop offloading your, you know, white protection on Asians. It doesn't work.
We've got to get to a point where we are self-sufficient again, Texas. And when it comes to health, also food, our food needs to be clean, number one. It just needs to be clean. And
Florida has pointed out, put that back on screen, all these major brands have got, like, you know, hundreds of times the glyphosate you should have.
Glyphosate.
Absolutely. Well, your doctor tells us what that does.
Oh, this is going to change your brain. This is going to set you up.
It erases your blood-brain barrier.
Oh, yeah.
So it's really an accelerant or an adjuvant. Absolutely. Everything in there. Explain that.
It destroys the blood-brain barrier. So that's a protective thing that happens between the cerebral spinal fluid and your fluids inside the brain and the things that attack it from the outside. Once that barrier is depleted, then it's subject to all kinds of heavy metals, things that get sprayed from the sky, right? Barium, aluminum, all these things that are it protects you from. Why methylene blue works? It does. It counters that. It's.
Oh, let me ask you that. 45 minutes in, you feel it, Doc?
Yeah, I feel pretty good.
Be honest though, you got your own special brand. Is this good or what?
No, this is the same effect I'm getting, but it feels right. Yeah, it feels right. Yeah, it's a little easier to take. Yeah.
By easier, what do you mean compared
just
to
the way it feels, you know, just going down, drinking it. But it's
so this one tastes better, but it's as good as the one your doctor gave.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow, so your doctor must have a good one.
We'll see. We'll go down the road a little ways, I'll text you.
Guys, get him a couple bottles of this. I need Doc Chambers endorsing this.
I'm not getting it for free, but I'll definitely help.
No, you're getting it down. Come on. Free, you're plus. It's amazing.
Hey, this is Doc Chambers here. I'm out in the field right now. Day off from the campaign trail, doing some work. I got things to catch up on, so it's called a refit day. But I'm getting refit with Alex Jones' methylene blue. It's pretty good. I got to say, I've been using it on the road since we left the studios. And I've been taking it for a while. I had a traumatic brain injury in Iraq in 2004. There's been a lot of studies out there that show that with post-dementia patients and TBI patients, it's been used for years. It's just not very well known with regard to demyelination, what it can do to improve your cognition. So that's your brain. Your brain housing these stuff. Hey, thanks, Alex. Appreciate you. We're going to stay on.
Powered by Methylene Blue, Ultra Methylene Blue at TheAlexJonesStore.com.
Whatever the future may hold, InfoWars will always live forever. The fight will continue. Be sure to follow us on X at RealAlexJones and at AJNLive. And now you can download the number one news app in the world. Go to AlexJonesApp.com and let the Democrat Deep State Party know that we will never be silenced.
Thanks for all your support. Today and tomorrow are the last days to get 100 times X entries into the amazing raffle where both of the offerings of the Shelby Mustang and the awesome Ford off-road truck, when you get 100X for every dollar you spend on the store, put into the raffle, you get put in for just the next 2 days, that's all that's left, to get both vehicles. That ends tomorrow. Every order in the site for a very limited time is this hat. And this is a classic design that I put out on InfoWars like 20 years ago. And it's a ring of, 13 stars around 1776. It's simple, it's clean, and it's just exciting, and it spreads the word. So every order, on top of the sales that are already there, for a limited time, gets a free 1776 ball cap at TheAlexJonesStore.com.
If you are receiving this transmission, you are the resistance.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is The War Room. We're going to be joined by Tiffany Cianci in the next hour. I know I'm going to talk about tariffs with her, but I want to show you a couple statements that were made and give you the rundown on what exactly is happening with the tariffs. And then I want to move on to the looming war with Iran that we're all so excited about. So, three justices warn majority is handcuffing President Trump's ability to fight foreign threats, with three members of the Supreme Court dissenting from the majority six-person decision to claim that all the tariffs were illegal. Supreme Court struck down Trump's biggest, boldest effort to secure our borders and rebuild American industry by basically claiming the tariffs are illegal. They claim to have ways of dealing with this and working around this. Of course, the biggest scandal out of this is the awareness of and understanding that Trump's Commerce Secretary, Howard Lutnick, had family who invested heavily in these tariffs, basically making billions of dollars now that they've been struck down. Howard Lutnick is the architect of Trump's tariff plan. He's the one who pushed Trump on these. And the exact same time he was doing this, Lutnick's sons, who he appointed to take over his bank, were betting the tariffs would be struck down and buying up refund rights at 25 cents on the dollar. And now that the government owes corporations refunds, and depending on how many refund slips they're holding, the Lutnick's bank could make billions of dollars. There's nothing else I can say about this that won't catch me a permaban from Mel at Village Crazy Lady. Trump's commerce secretary loves tariffs. His former investment bank is taking bets against them. That seems criminal to me. So his family just made billions of dollars because the policy that he pushed to have Trump invoke is going to cost the American taxpayers billions of dollars. Sounds suspicious to me. Sounds like corruption, in fact. Let's go to clip 25 here. This is Secretary Scott Bessent, Treasury Secretary, talking about how the Trump administration is going to deal with the Supreme Court ruling from today. Let's watch.
I would also like to take a moment to address today's Supreme Court ruling, and I would note that I did not change a single word in my speech post the ruling. President Trump will always put our national security and Americans first. And as I have said before, the president has multiple tools in his toolbox. Let's be clear about what today's ruling was and what it wasn't. Despite the misplaced gloating from Democrats, ill-informed media outlets, and the very people who gutted our industrial base, the court did not rule against President Trump's tariffs. Six justices simply ruled that IEEPA authorities cannot be used to raise even $1 of revenue. This administration will invoke alternative legal authorities to replace the IEEPA tariffs. We will be leveraging Section 232 and Section 301 tariff authorities that have been validated through thousands of legal challenges. Treasury's estimates show that the use of Section 122 authority, combined with potentially enhanced Section 232 and Section 301 tariffs, will result in virtually unchanged tariff revenue in 2026.
Okay, so essentially they're saying that the problem was the methodology by which the tariffs were enacted, not the tariffs themselves, so they're going to basically be litigating this for the next couple years. So that's good. That'll be a good use of resources and time and attention for us. Fantastic. As MJ Truth Ultra on X puts it, there is a plan B. Within Justice Kavanaugh's dissent, he says the Supreme Court got it wrong, but says Trump still has all the cards. The IEEPA law does not let the president impose tariffs during a national emergency, based on its text, history, and precedent. The majority wrongly applied the strict major questions doctrine to block it in foreign affairs and trade. Even if the ruling stands, presidents can likely impose similar for most of or most of the same tariffs using these other trade laws instead. Trade Expansion Act of 1962, the Trade Act of 1974, or the Tariff Act of 1930. These require a few extra steps, like investigations, but cover the tariffs at issue. Bottom line, legally, he says this was the wrong call, but presidents have major workarounds via those other statutes. However, it's going to be a giant and expensive and time-consuming battle before we ever get to the bottom of anything. And again, from the Gateway Pundit article, talks about the three very strong dissensions. The justices called the decision a dangerous power grab by the judiciary, ignoring historical precedent and the clear intent of Congress to empower the president in times of emergency. President Trump, shortly after reclaiming the White House in 2025, declared a national emergency over the public health crisis caused by illegal drugs pouring out of Canada, Mexico, and China, and the hollowing out of American manufacturing due to massive trade deficits. Using IEEPA, a law passed in 1977, to give presidents tools to fight foreign threats, he slapped tariffs on imports, 25% on most Canadian and Mexican goods, et cetera, et cetera. Roberts, joined by the usual suspects, Sotomayor, Kagan, and Jackson, and turncoat Barrett and Gorsuch, invoked the so-called major questions doctrine to block Trump's America First agenda. They argued tariffs are a taxing power reserved for Congress, ignoring that emergencies demand swift action from the commander-in-chief. Justice Samuel Alito didn't write separately, but joined Kavanaugh's dissent in full, signaling his full-throated agreement that the ruling is a dangerous overstep. Which, you know, I get, you know, according to J.D. Vance, he says, you know, that the president is endowed by the Constitution with the right to basically manage foreign trade. And this is just an aspect of foreign trade. It's not a tax per se. If it was a tax, that would be something the Congress would have to do. But if it's about regulating foreign trade, then it would be the president's prerogative. Again, how this goes, it's kind of hard to say, but it's basically where we are. Gorsuch and Roberts strongly suggest in their decision, so Gorsuch and Roberts are the ones who decided that tariffs are illegal and should be removed. They strongly suggest that if Trump had only done what Nixon did, that is temporary tariffs at a consistent capped rate, SCOTUS would not have taken the case. It was his madman routine of making up crazy new tax rates every morning that doomed him. So that's the reading from Maxwell Meyer on X, with these statements saying basically from the decisions from the Supreme Court saying things like, and because laws must earn such broad support to survive the legislative process, they tend to endure, allowing ordinary people to plan their lives in ways that they cannot when the rules shift from day to day. Saying the president asserts the extraordinary power to unilaterally impose tariffs on an unlimited amount, duration, and scope. In light of the breadth, history, and constitutional context of that asserted authority, he must identify clear congressional authorization to exercise it. IEEPA's grant of authority to regulate importation falls short. IEEPA contains no reference to tariffs or duties. The government points to no statute in which Congress uses the word regulate to authorize taxation, and until now, no president has ever read IEEPA to confer such power. We claim no special competence in the matter of economics or foreign affairs. We claim only, as we must, the limited role assigned to us by Article 3 of the Constitution. Fulfilling that role, we hold the IEEPA does not authorize the president to impose tariffs. And they say those tariffs are also of limited amount, duration, and scope. The previous tariffs that were deemed constitutional were of a limited amount, duration, and scope, noting that a 10% surcharge was described by President Nixon as a temporary measure and was in effect for less than 5 months, applied only to articles which had been the subject of prior tariff concessions and was capped at congressionally authorized rates. So again, basically saying that if he had done it in a more strategic way or had even gotten Congress to go along with him, then it wouldn't be an issue. And so then the controversy comes in that it apparently was Howard Lutnick that advised Trump to take this tack and that this would be a tariff strategy that would succeed. And now that that was wrong and that all these tariffs and specifically the method by which the tariffs were applied has been rejected, his bank and his family is making potentially billions and billions of dollars off it. Lutnick swindles America again, from DD_geopolitics. The Supreme Court just ruled Trump's tariffs illegal. Guess who's about to make a fortune off this? Cantor Fitzgerald, the firm now run by Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick's sons, has been buying the rights to tariff refunds from the U.S. importers at pennies on the dollar. Here's how the scheme works. U.S. companies paid billions in tariffs that are now ruled illegal. Cantor approaches those companies and says, I'll give you $0.25 now for every dollar you're owed in refunds. Companies take the quick cash rather than wait years for the legal process. When the refunds come through, Cantor collects the full dollar. Lutnick, quote-unquote, divested from Cantor by handing it to his 20-something sons and placing his equity in a trust for those same sons. He paid zero capital gains tax on the transfer. As Commerce Secretary, Lutnick has direct visibility into the government's legal strategy, how their lawyers rate their odds, and what agreements they'll make, his family's firm betting against the very tariffs his boss created. His family's firm was and is betting against the very tariffs his boss created. They bought a 25 cents on the dollar, and after today's SCOTUS ruling, those rights could well be worth 80 to 90 cents. The potential payout could be in the billions, insider trading with a couple extra steps. Hard to argue otherwise. Because you understand they would have lost a ton of money if the tariffs had been proven to be valid. So a business gets a tariff. They lose money from the tariff. Cantor goes to them and says, you know, you lost $1 million. We'll give you $250,000, and you'll give up the rights to whatever potential windfall would come if these are reversed and they have to return the money to you. And so by paying 25 cents, they're now essentially getting 80 to 90 cents back from that, meaning that they are basically tripling their investment. And yet if the tariff decision had gone the other way, they would have lost out on all of that money they'd invested. It all would have been nothing because there would be no money to get back. So all of those 25 cent on the dollar transactions would have been just pure losses for Lutnick. I'm sorry, for the business that Lutnick temporarily handed to his nepotistic sons. Great. Top of family of top Trump official stands to make fortune from tariffs ruling. Quote, pure criminality. So, what a lucky and clever guy this Howard Lutnick is, huh? He advises Trump on something. Trump sort of stakes his entire operation off this strategy. Turns out not to work. Bad news for Trump. Extremely good news for Howard Lutnick, his family, and his business partners. Isn't that amazing? Let's go to clip 32 here. This was a statement made by Trump following the announcement of the tariffs, saying that he is going to continue to tariff people, but just on a blanket worldwide tariff rather than an individual basis. Let's go to clip 32.
Which have also been confirmed and are fully allowed. Therefore, effective immediately, all national security tariffs under Section 232 and existing Section 301 tariffs, they're existing, they're there, remain in place, fully in place, and in full force and effect. Today, I will sign an order to impose a 10% global tariff under Section 122 over and above our normal tariffs already being charged. And we're also initiating several Section 301 and other investigations to protect our country from unfair trading practices of other countries and companies.
Okay, so 10% blanket tariffs on everybody in the world. He also made some other statements during this press conference about the looming conflict with Iran. We continue to pile military equipment into the Middle East for this promised boondoggle. Let's go to clip 34 here. Trump gives his reasoning for why he's going to war with all these places. Let's watch.
Can't charge a dollar. I would have used one penny, but we don't make the pennies anymore. We save money. Can't charge $1 to any country under IEEPA. Not $1. I assume to protect other countries. This must have been done to protect those other countries. Certainly not the United States of America, which they should be interested in protecting. That's what they're supposed to be protecting. But I am allowed to cut off any and all trade or business with that same country. In other words, I can destroy the trade. I can destroy the country. I'm even allowed to impose a foreign country-destroying embargo. I can embargo. I can do anything I want, but I can't charge $1. Because that's not what it says. And that's not the way it even reads. I can do anything I want to do to them, but I can't charge any money. So I'm allowed to destroy the country, but I can't charge them a little fee. I could give them a little two-cent fee, but I cannot charge under any circumstances. I cannot charge them anything.
Yeah, that's actually a good point. They're saying that the president of the United States has the ability to put sanctions and embargoes on countries, totally destroy them economically, but he can't charge them a percentage. Yeah, that's a little inconsistent, actually. That doesn't make any sense. But then again, what does these days? A spokesperson for Cantor Fitzgerald said they never executed any transactions or taken the risk on the legality of tariffs. The firm claimed a salesman mistakenly believed the product would be approved and began pitching it prematurely, but that management ultimately decided against the business due to political sensitivities. So they're saying that's not true. Well, I don't know. It's been reported by a bunch of mainstream media. I know they're not exactly the most honest brokers in the world, but that would be a pretty hefty defamation case if they got that wrong. But hey, could be so. Let's talk about Iran. Let's talk about the war with Iran. Let's talk about stupidity and the just ill-advised nature of our entire relationship with the state of Israel. You know, Tucker Carlson and interviewed Mike Huckabee and basically humiliated and destroyed his every talking point. It was really not, didn't go well for the our Zionist ambassador. And I'll go to a clip or two of that here in just a second. But I want to first go to clip number 9. This is Greg Stoker, who's running for Congress here in Texas in the 31st District. Here's him laying out brilliantly the reality about our interaction with the state of Iran. Let's watch.
U.S. military preparations for another distance conflict against Iran will be complete by the weekend as the most hardware has been deployed to the Persian Gulf since 2002. The green light still hasn't been given by the White House, but when talking about this from the imperial perspective, please stop calling this a regime change operation. This is not a regime change operation. Then that hasn't been the plan for years. The play is ethnic balkanization, and you can thank the neocons at the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies and their colleagues in Tel Aviv for this policy. There is no Persian government in exile drafting a constitution ready to take over while a revolutionary vanguard-esque element seizes the institutions for an orderly transition of power. That would never be allowed to happen, as the U.S. and Israel have no interest in establishing a new government that would potentially be sucked into Russian or Chinese spheres of influence. And that means deep destabilization and balkanization into easily controllable resource fiefdoms along ethnic and territorial lines. So military strikes to weaken out the state alongside economic warfare and support for sectarianism. From the imperial perspective, if we could have regime changed Iran decades ago, we would have, when the economic and military might of the empire wasn't in such decline. Now the only play is a failed state, with security guarantees for Sunni, Azeri, Kurdish, and Balochi minorities willing to break away, and for the uncreated state of what Washington warhawks call South Azerbaijan. The idea that stirring separatist sentiment in concert with U.S. military action will fracture Iran is a bloody fantasy, and one that deliberately overlooks how schemes hatched, in large part by pro-Israel neocons, have backfired in Iraq and Syria, leaving chaos in their wake. And this impending war will literally destabilize the globe. Turkey will never brook U.S. support for Kurdish separatism in Iran. Similarly, Pakistan, already facing its own Baloch insurgency, will see Western meddling as a direct threat to its territorial integrity. Russia and China will be proven right and will speed along their multipolar coalition building. India will similarly reject this policy. It would devastatingly undermine New Delhi's trade and logistic projects in the region, and on and on and on. A destabilized Iran would lead to untold deaths and a migration crisis that would dwarf 2015 Syria. It would be fertile recruiting grounds for ISIS Khorasan, which would be a great excuse to heighten more direct U.S. security involvement. Contractors in the failed state, and will cause energy shocks across the globe, and Europe will face a self-inflicted disaster, and a lot of U.S. troops will die in the opening days of this whole operation. Declining empires are always brazen and vindictive, lashing out in all directions, taking insane risks, acting without a coherent plan, wreaking havoc everywhere, as the material conditions of their own citizens are completely immiserated. For the sake of humanity, the U.S. empire must be dismantled root and branch. Again, they're not going for regime change, as that is not possible. They're going for balkanization.
So I think he's fairly on the money about that. He sounds like a socialist to me. But this is the problem, is that the way that Trump is acting is feeding the fire of their arguments. It's giving all the credence to their, you know, claims about America being this evil empire. In actuality, that's how we're acting. So we can stop acting like that, and then they won't have anything to complain about, but we insist on proving them right. So I don't know what else to say. I do think the American empire as it exists now does need to be destroyed root and branch, because I love America and I want America to flourish, and I'm sick of our interests being completely tossed to the side in favor of these ridiculous overseas adventures. And remember, this is where it ties all back in together from the beginning of the show, of the fact that 911 won't respond to calls of women who are being attacked by their boyfriends. We can't get our elementary school kids in classrooms that actually teach them anything. Our economy is absolutely collapsing, and what little is propped up, the vast majority of the American people are being deliberately excluded from taking those jobs. So, yeah, screw this whole system. Like, what the hell are we doing? The material conditions of the average American are worse than they were 20 years ago. Everything is degrading rapidly. And we're spending infinite time and resources and effort and energy and potentially lives so that Israel can kill people with impunity. And remember, that's what it's all about. The AP just came out with an article, a look at the U.S. military assets in the Middle East, just describing the enormous buildup of military equipment there. However, it's this line down at the bottom that's gotten a lot of attention and should really be in the forefront of the military planners. In the segment called Expectations of Retaliation, they say many likely expect Iran to, quote, just keep firing drones and cruise missiles back at Israel and American bases in regard to almost everything we might do. He said Iran could go bigger and broader, especially if its leadership feels targeted. Vaez, an Iranian expert for the International Crisis Group, said Iran is unlikely to limit its response, as it did after the U.S. struck its nuclear facilities in June. Iran had signaled that when and how it would retaliate so that there was very little damage done. They have now come to the conclusion that the only way that they can stop this cycle is to draw blood and to inflict significant harm on the U.S. and Israel, even if that comes at a very high price for themselves. Yeah, that's the logical conclusion to come to. And again, there's no point for them to negotiate. Every time they do, America stabs them in the back, bombs their negotiators, or lets Israel bomb their negotiators and screws them over. Remember, we were negotiating last time. We bombed them in the middle of negotiations. So everything we've done has disincentivized Iran from cooperating or mitigating their aggressiveness. No. They're incentivized entirely to throw everything they can at us. And I'm frankly surprised that they're waiting so long. If I was Iran, I might not have been so patient. I want to go quickly to a last video before we finish the hour. Clip 27. This is a new revelation about Israel's genocide. Let's watch.
The death toll in Gaza is 50% higher than originally reported, according to a new study. The Lancet Medical Journal said that 75,000 people were killed in the first 16 months of the conflict. That figure is 25,000 more than the death toll originally reported by the Gaza Health Ministry. Israel has consistently disputed the figure, but last month a senior security officer made a U-turn and said that the original data reported was close to accurate.
Today and tomorrow, the last days to get 100 times X entries into the amazing raffle. It only happens every few months, where both of the offerings of the Shelby Mustang and the awesome Ford off-road truck, 100X for every dollar you spend on the store, put into the raffle. You get put in for just the next 2 days, is all that's left, to get both vehicles. There's a time where there's a crossover for 1 week. That ends tomorrow. Every order in the site for a very limited time, it's probably just last throughout the weekend, I'm told, because is this hat. And this is a classic design that I put out on InfoWars like 20 years ago. I noticed everybody else copied it, which is cool. I just go, why don't we have that classic design back? So they brought it back, and it's a ring of, 13 stars around 1776. And it's simple, it's clean, and a leftist probably won't kill you or murder you for it. You know, if you have like a MAGA or InfoWars hat, that's a real adventure. This is just at the airport or wherever, hey, patriots know. And it's just exciting, spreads the word. So every order, on top of the sales that are already there, for a limited time, gets a free 1776 ball cap at thealexjonesstore.com. And if you're going to buy anything on the store, become a VIP for $30 a month. You can cancel any time for free. Instantly, you get $40 to spend each month. The minute you click that button for $30, you get $40 to spend. Special deals, special offers, special sales, top everything. So anybody buying anything should be a VIP. And it's really no commitment. You just get better deals. Cancel any time for free. One click in your profile. Everyone should be a VIP. Also, sometimes stuff runs out and sells out. You don't want it to happen? Become a subscriber. Cancel any time. They hold it back for you at the biggest discounts as well. Become a VIP, become a subscriber. But regardless, share the live feeds of the show. Tell folks about those local AM and FM stations, cable stations, because that's how we reach the people and that's how we change the world. The whole globalist house of cards is coming down. We've been vindicated. You've been vindicated. Nothing's going to stop that. Stay with us. Massive guest straight ahead.
If you are receiving this transmission, you are the resistance.